It's hello, Don. This is with regard to distortion correction, and we've discussed this a little bit today. And what I want to do is go over this, and I've actually got a comment that I'm writing, and this is a comment on a paper by Sasaki and Meiji. So I'm going to be submitting this soon. So I'm just showing it you now so you can prepare your response. You know? But essentially, what we want to determine, and this is a standard distortion, we want to determine some regional tensor that describes the Earth. But the problem is that we have distortions that distort our tensor. They're at a scale size that we cannot handle. That means that our modeling codes currently cannot handle from the 1 meter, 10 meter scale of our measurement to the tens of kilometers of scale of the Earth. And so an approximation that's worked very well in two dimensions and in one dimensions is to suck all that information that we cannot model into this galvanic distorter. Now, this galvanic distorter, at high frequencies, also has a magnetic bar, but we'll ignore that. But this is just a 2x2 real galvanic distorter. So what we observe at any site is this distortion times the times our regional. Now, and by you know that we can express this distorter as a 2x2 real frequency independent, and there's a whole bunch of papers. Interesting when you look at the theory of this, actually, in one dimensions, here's the one dimensional tensor. The reason, of course, I have the minus sign here is to try and get the right hand rule, right? And then we're distorting this, and the person that first came up with this was Jimmy Larson in 1976, his Hawaii distortions. And then this was extended into two dimensions. Actually, the very first paper that discusses this is written in German in 1982 in one of these German workshop reports by, you can't see it, but it's Richard, Stäbeling and Schmucker. And what we observe clearly, let me just what we observe is that the 2D regional galvanically distorted and then rotated. So this is what we're observing, and there's 8 parameters there, but unfortunately there's 9 parameters there, and I won't go into the whole discussion of Dick Bailey and Ross Groom and how to do that. The problem comes to 3D, when we're trying to solve the 3D problem. Here we have a 3D tensor, and we're distorting this now by this 2x2 distortion matrix. And you can see that what we observed in the top right diagonal is a combination of a static shifted version of the true Earth plus a static shifted version of the element below it. And the same for the YX component. We see a static shifted version of the true component plus a static shifted version of the diagonal term above it. And so if you apply a static shift correction, you're essentially saying that this term can be ignored and this term can be ignored. Okay? And that's only true in the 2D case, or in the case where the distortion is such that B and C are zero. And so the distortion method, the static shift distortion, just solving for static shifts on top of 3D, is essentially saying that you can ignore this mixing that happens because of distortion. Now, as we saw yesterday from the Dublin test model, we saw very small diagonal terms. And so in the case when there's small diagonal terms, the approximation's fine. But the secret model has got very large diagonal terms in it. And so that you cannot apply a static shift, a simple static shift. What you have to solve for is the full, and this is, I think, what we should be doing. You have to solve for a regional 3D that's galvanically distorted at each of your sites. And so you're solving at each site, you've got your observations, you've got 8 observations, unfortunately you've got 12 unknowns in. So
probably start this before we have more data.
It's the same all frequencies. Okay, yeah, if you do. All right, let's say you've got n frequencies, you've got 8n unknowns, you've got 8n plus 4 unknowns. So you do have a little bit of a problem in solving it, but you could still try to fit separately for structure of the Earth that is fits whatever sort of norm you like. The sort of misfit, and I'll talk tomorrow about misfit, but also tries to take out this frequency independent part that's mixed in for certain sites. It's going to be sites where you have corners and where you have, and this I think is really important, because as we were looking at the secret model, we found that we particularly chose that because we got very large diagonal terms, and in fact it was those diagonal terms that really resolved structure.
How often in the data you collect do you think are distorted?
Huge amount. Huge. A long period. Huge amount.
But at long periods, like periods, what, greater than 1,000 seconds?
10, 100. I mean, it all scales. It's all relative, isn't it? I mean, if you remember, Randy, that when I gave you the slave data, there were probably about 30% of sites that you couldn't automatically put in because the phases are out of quadrants and all sorts of distortions are happening. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, this has been done by Catherine de Groot-Hedlin in 2D. It should be very easy to do it in 3D.
I'm going to comment to it. Actually, I'm going to talk about this tomorrow, but I'm going to comment to one of your statements. I just say that it's all scale dependent, but it's hardly not true, because as you go the longer period, model, and at some stage you can model it, because you have the right scaling yourself, right? So it's only the other part, in 3D models, it is only that part of the structure that has a scale length similar to the dimension of the cells that you can put into the static shift parameter. It is not the longer the data as such. They are already represented by the 3D model.
Yeah, theoretically, but as we've seen today, the 3D model mesh, inversion meshes, are fairly small. I mean, we've seen 50 by 50 by 30, or, you know, and even those are taking quite a bit of time. So, you know, if you want to model something the size of Southern Africa like I do, it's going to be impossible to model it on the scale size of the whole of Southern Africa from, you know, the experimental scale to the regional scale. And so you're going to have to use this approximation. Eventually we won't have to do this, you know, when Greg's got his supercomputer. That's
exactly what the concave parameters were under the test.
it gets back to this question of parsimony. Who was talking about parsimony? You know, you really want to be efficient in spending the computing time solving the problem you really want to understand, which is some sort of regional structure, and then put as much... I think this is the easiest way of getting rid of all that distortion stuff and not waste a lot of cycles on the distortion stuff.
But the distortion that you're worried about, is that coming from large scale structure, or is it coming from just little bits of stuff at the surface?
At any frequency, right, you will see distorters that are galvanic only, distorters that have a magnetic component as well as galvanic only. You'll see distorters that are inductive 3D and inductive 2D. We're living in a very complex Earth. And as you go down in frequency, you're going to be summing up all these distortion matrices. I mean, basically what you want to do is almost a distortion stripping. You start at the highest frequency and do some sort of estimate of your distortion temps at the highest frequency and strip that off. And then try and invert for the rest of the structure.
But if we kind of go back to the ideas that Ted Natalie had, you know, years ago about trying to go from large scale to smaller scale, then the problem, if it's large scale, just a distortion, then it's a matter of putting the wrong boundary conditions on the region that really is of interest. If we have the right boundary conditions for that large scale distortion, then perhaps we would be correct, you know, the little static shifts caused by the stuff that's right here in the electrode. We can model that stuff out eventually. It's the big scale we need to worry about.
My
question really is whether or not, if it is big scale and it's just connected with the boundary conditions, can we somehow set up the inverse problem where the boundary conditions are large scale, smooth, but unknown? And then we've got two kinds of scales of things. One is to actually try to find that, smooth, large-scale boundary conditions, as well as the conductivity that's inside.
I mean, that makes sense. When I think of the work Chabi and I did at Okak Bay, I don't know if you remember that paper, where a company was getting real-time interpretation done, and they had a drilling rig there, and they were hammering on the person to provide an interpretation. And an interpretation was provided that led to a 1.5 kilometre hole being drilled in northern Labrador that was dry, in the mineral exploration sense. And we were asked to look at those data, and it turned out the phases were okay. It's the apparent resistivities that really dropped like a stone. And what we appealed to, in fact, was that the Atlantic Ocean was just 25 kilometres away. And you're seeing regional currents from the Atlantic Ocean that were being channeled through a conductor that was shallower and that had been well imaged, and was causing the apparent resistivity curves to drop greater than 45 degrees. And it was that drop that had been misinterpreted by, to say the not so innocent, I won't tell you his name, in the camp.
But was the 3D inversions actually able to reproduce?
No, this was 3D forward modeling.
Okay, doesn't matter. Were you able to reproduce those data?
Not entirely. No, not entirely. It's still a bit of an enigma, actually, those data. And if anybody's interested to look at them, we could help us with them. We could have another crack now. Now you've got these 3D inverse codes, maybe we could distribute that Okak Bay data set.
So which journal do you plan to submit this missive?
Which journal? Where did you publish your paper? this is a comment on this paper. There you go. Was it?
JGR.
Yeah. So, if there's any editors of JGR out there? Okay.
Just following the loop that was coming up.
Yes. Yes. No, no, no. For the perfect data, you don't need this. No, no. You don't need this. When you need this is when you're recording real data and you've got local distortions around your electrode array. This is when you need this. I mean, no, for perfect data, you don't need this at all. You can try. The comment is that, I think this is a more efficient way. I mean, it'd be useful to try both, actually. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Does anyone else have anything?